We have an opportunity today. If we miss it, our not only children and grandchildren, but great-grandchildren and future generations thereafter will be harmed in irreversible ways. If you believe and respect the principle of intergenerational equity, what do you do differently on Monday morning?
Welcome to another episode of Multilateralism Unpacked. My name is Dawia Shalali, and I work on long-term governance at UN University Center for Policy Research. This episode is the first in a series where we explore how to answer a critical policy question. How do we make decisions that are just for people and planet now and do not harm people and planet long into the future? For this first episode, I have invited one of the most influential voices in international environmental law, Professor Edith Brownwise from Georgetown University. She has shaped how the world understands the very concept of sustainability and advised major global institutions through the negotiation of the first environmental treaties. In our conversation today, we have revisited some of the key concepts of her landmark book, In Fairness to Future Generations, and we explored the relevance of intergenerational equity in our present context, from energy transition and demographic changes to pension reforms. Our challenges are far more complex and interconnected than those imagined when environmental treaties were first written. We start the interview with a simple question. How should we define intergenerational equity, and where does this principle come from?
Intergenerational equity is basically a principle of fairness between past, present, and future generations. And there are two parts to that. One is that we are partners with other generations in caring for the Earth and for the human environment. And we also have a relationship to the natural system, to Earth itself and the social systems. And that's a partnership also. So what does that mean? What it means is that we have an obligation to pass the Earth, its natural resources, its cultural resources, to future generations in at least as good a condition as we received them on balance, so that future generations can benefit from and use the Earth to meet their own needs. And I have argued that this means providing comparable diversity or options. It means providing comparable quality, and it means providing equitable access, non-discriminatory equitable access to use and benefit from the Earth. Now, you ask where it comes from. And intergenerational equity, or intergenerational fairness, has deep roots in the diverse cultural and religious traditions, whether it be the Judeo-Christian tradition, Islamic law, which focuses on the community, other religious traditions, importantly, indigenous peoples, customary laws in Africa, very important source, and other areas, including in the common law and civil law. I think it's also a primordial social value that has deep biological roots, namely that people care for their offspring unless they're fighting for their survival. And they care about that there is a future and that something will happen in the future. Now, what about international law? Because the principle of intergenerational equity, I contend, is a principle of international law. And here I think it relies on the deep tradition of using equity, a principle of equity. Originally, equity was to interpret legal instruments in order to reach decisions that were fair, but it also has a basis in international law for the standards to allocate and to share resources. And so it's really based on equity. There is a contention in international law where you look backwards, but this one looks forward, and that's really a new element. And finally, I would say, why are these norms or principles important? And I think they're really essential because they shape what we do, or should shape what we do, and importantly, what we expect others to do. And young people get this. I would add one thing, which is that when I first initiated this work, which was back in the very early 1980s, I was very fortunate to have the United Nations University Vice Rector at that time approach me and say, would you like a little support? And it came in the form of support for an advisory committee so that the principles would be rooted within different cultural, economic, and political traditions. And the then small group, in chronological order, included distinguished people from Brazil, from China, from France, from India, and the vice rector of Sweden, and briefly a person from Africa. So that really helped me develop my thinking and my roots. And I should tell you that as a group, the advisory group actually produced something called the Goa Declaration on Future Generations. And eventually, of course, there was a very important UNESCO declaration on the responsibilities of present generations to future generations that Jacques Cousteau had a leading role in urging and pressing for.
Thank you very much. And in these legal principles, whether in international law and in other national examples, does this mean that concretely future generations do have human rights? And has it been implemented anywhere?
There are two aspects to this. Yes, future generations do have human rights. And that concept is that existing international human rights extend to future generations. We've had a very important, very recent decision this month, advisory opinion from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, that says very clearly that human rights encompass and extend to future generations. The issue is also now before the African Court on Human Rights and a request for an advisory opinion. I have argued that there's also a separate way of conceiving of human rights of future generations, and that is simply rights of future generations that are related to their role and place in relationship to the present and the past. That there is a group right, a collective right of future generations that doesn't depend upon knowing how many individuals there are or what their makeup is or anything. Rather, it's as a class, and that we have obligations to them and they have rights. And this is important that they have rights, because if you have a right, you have to have an obligation. You can have an obligation without a right. And so then one must ask, well, what are the kinds of rights that future generations have as a class, a group right? And I think that that is defined by asking about what do you need for the robustness, the integrity, the long-term protection and conservation of the earth and of the human environment? What about the resilience? This is all part of it. So what kinds of things would be covered if one took this as an example of a collective group right of future generations? And some things that might be covered there are a seabed that's free of nuclear contamination, access to fresh water, potentially arable land and productive soils, groundwater that's not contaminated with toxic chemicals, and biodiversity of tropical forests and marine environments. All of those things could be considered, I think, as relating to the resilience and the integrity and the robustness of the earth and of the human environment. I would also include cultural resources in this.
And do you have an example of a good use of this principle at the national or international level? What has it led to since it has been, let's say, enforced in international law?
There have been a lot of examples of this and a lot of cases. Since 2015 and 2025, more than 100 cases have been filed within countries that have involved intergenerational equity. More than 20 have been filed before national Supreme Courts, more than 8 before national constitutional courts, and as I mentioned, several before international human rights courts, including the European Court of Human Rights and the Inter-American Court of Human Rights and the African Court of Human Rights. Now, there have been four kinds of cases that have come before courts, and I've charted them into those related to climate change, and a vast majority relate to climate change, where they've had some very successful results. The mining of mineral resources, where they've also had successful results. Other natural resource issues, and pollution control, where there's an important case in Kenya relating to the dumping of sewage into water rather than into using sewage plants. Now, I want to actually focus on the mining of mineral resources, because this is a situation that many people may not know that much about. What happened is in 2017, the Supreme Court in India issued a path-breaking decision called Common Cause Against the Union of India that regarded mining in Odisha. A decision of the Supreme Court ordered the government to revise its national policy on mineral resources in light of a principle of intergenerational equity. And the revised mining policy states that natural resources, including minerals, are a shared inheritance where the state is a trustee on behalf of the people to ensure that future generations receive the benefit of the inheritance. And the revised policy established an interministerial mechanism for sustainable development to review mining activities within the context of the principles of sustainable development and intergenerational equity. There was also an earlier decision on iron ore mining in Goa, where the court invoked the Indian Constitution and intergenerational equity to require mining leases in the future to deposit 10% of the sale proceeds into a new Goa iron ore permanent fund for sustainable development and intergenerational equity. I do think there are still issues with implementing that. But that's an example of where the courts are making a huge difference, in my view, in implementing intergenerational equity. Now, sometimes it's contained, the relevant provisions are in the constitution of the country. They can be used. Sometimes they're in legislation, and sometimes they're directly invoking from international law the principle of intergenerational equity.
Very interesting to see how this principle has come into action very concretely and has also supported, I guess, grassroots movements into the protection of their resources. And sometimes I feel it's really embedded as well in indigenous principles of stewardship towards the future. Now, how do you think that, you know, it's a little bit difficult to talk about this topic of protecting future generations sometimes when some would argue very rightly that in the present, we are already so much in need and we have so many crises to solve and our governments, but also our courts are filled with a sense of urgency to respond and to be responsive to the now. But why do you think, first of all, that this topic of protecting future generations and applying intergenerational equity is important right now? And how do you think that member states and the UN system can take this forward and this principle and this position of stewardship really seriously?
It's absolutely critical to do it now because the pressures are for short-term thinking, short-term engagement, short-term solving of problems. And I would add, we have serious problems with equity today that do need to be solved in addition to all the other issues. But if we only focus on the short term, we're going to continue to have even worse problems in the future because we aren't addressing them. So if you're asking about what we do today really affects the future, it can make it even harder to deal with all of these issues in the future. So therefore, we really have to have a strategy for addressing the future. Otherwise, it's going to be more costly, the Earth's more vulnerable, and people suffering more. It's really essential.
And I feel as well that sometimes it's looking at the symptoms and not the root causes, which perhaps the principle of intergenerational equity is really trying to address as well, having preventive strategies and early warning systems embedded in policy thinking to support preventing rather than being in reactive response. And even more right now, perhaps now that we are in times of in critical windows or tipping points or thresholds, as would call the Earth system scientists, if we do not invest now, we might go into an irreversible situation. So would you say that it's even more urgent now than ever if we take into account this context of tipping points, planetary boundaries that we are crossing more and more now that since 2024, we know that we've surpassed the plus 1.5 degrees. Would you say that it's even more useful now to think seriously about this principle and its application? Or would you say that it's part of a continuum that should be not deprioritized in times of crisis, but that could be as, let's say, background thinking when in times of crisis?
Clearly, it's critical now. We can reach tipping points. We'll cross them. It's going to be hard ever to reverse those critical tipping points. That's particularly true in the climate area. But there are also other new technologies where we might be able to benefit from them, but the really potential long-term harms that we have to deal with, such as in synthetic biology. If we don't do it today, we're going to lose the opportunity to do it successfully in the future. It should always be part of background thinking, critical today. We have an opportunity to now, if we miss it, our not only children and grandchildren, but great-grandchildren and future generations thereafter will be harmed in irreversible ways.
Thank you. And my last question will be a little bit more personal, I would say. Can you tell us a story of this movement of intergenerational equity, of thinkers, pioneers of intergenerational equity, and perhaps a victory that you have felt was impossible to have, but still was adopted? I feel that in these times of despair and shortening of opportunities, we really feel the need to know more about stories of things that were seemed impossible at the time, but that we are still benefiting from today. So yeah, can you tell us a personal story about it, if you have one?
My personal story is that when I first started doing the research and writing on a principle of intergenerational equity and looking into it, it was in the legal field, not there in international law. I was very fortunate to have an advisory group, and we worked together. And I have begun tracing since then sort of what's happened. And it's amazing that now in 2025, we have more than 100 court cases, really many more than 100 court cases, that we have accepted a principle of intergenerational equity. We have the Maastricht principles on intergenerational equity. We have the common principles that were drafted to inform the UN staff. It's amazing. It takes a while for ideas to develop and to be accepted. And I tend to think of it on the timescale of a generation, where they're beginning to be there, then they get quite implemented, and then the generation after that, it's routine. I think things are happening faster than that. And my personal story is that the original book that I wrote, that the UNU was a co-publisher on, was then translated into French, thanks to Jacques Cousteau and the then head of UNESCO, which arranged for that. It was translated into Japanese, translated into Spanish, and translated into Chinese. That's important because now you have, I think, an awareness, especially of young people around the world, that they have to care about the future because what we're doing today can endanger them in the future and actually not promote the benefits that they need in the future and not develop the benefits that they need for the future. So it's a personal story of seeing growth across the world, across generations, in this, and now the United Nations taking a really, I think, important role. And I want to use this opportunity to talk about what I'm going to call an ecosystem of future generations. And I use the term ecosystem, and my colleague Jane Stromseth has used it for ecosystem of accountability. But I think the UN has a critical role there, really one of the central roles in developing an ecosystem of future generations. And the ecosystem has to include the private sector as well, the financial institutions, civil society, non-governmental organizations, certainly indigenous people who have so much from which we can learn. But it also means that in the UN itself, they need to be able to reach down or at least filter down, not only just at the government level, but let it filter down to the sub-governmental levels within the country. And I think it's important for each part of the UN to have some kind of a focal point so that each entity in the UN could have a focal point that's known as a focal point for considering the future. Because what we want is for all decisions to have an element in which, yes, we have considered the future implications of this. They might be good, by the way, or they might be harmful, but it's important to do that. And in that focal point, that means that it should be integrated in all the decisions that are made. And one could even conceive position descriptions within different entities, having an element in the program description that says to consider the future in the projects or programs or decisions that are made. One could also consider having a UN forum for discussion of the future, a regular forum across the UN system to direct and exchange ideas, discuss problems, share data, and perhaps link with other organizations, other international intergovernmental organizations. One could conceive, when one talks about strategic assessments, that one could conceive of looking at science and technology assessments into the future. 20, 30 years from now, what would we want science and technology to be used for? Not just for wealthy, but for all people. And we could call attention to problems that are likely to be neglected and see if they, for example, could be addressed. Or to develop a center that records what works, what doesn't work. Essentially a center for lessons learned. A need to reach out to local communities, especially Indigenous peoples, as well as look at larger scale stories here. An effort to help build the capacity of countries and civil society to consider the future. And helping build the capacity of countries that would be to identify issues, problems, opportunities to benefit for future generations. Identify sources for understanding future issues and problems and assessing them and managing them. And in this context, to develop educational materials that young people everywhere will be able to access and understand them in the context of their own culture, their own political and economic system. And building capacity to monitor projects and programs to see what happens and to hold institutions and people accountable. I also see a role for the UN as being an advocate for future generations, including having programs such as your own, the podcast, and social media. But I do have a word of warning to everyone, and that is we always need to guard against misinformation or disinformation, and to be careful that special interests don't co-opt the process and that short-term interests don't get disguised as long-term interests. I think all of these things could be central as we think about the possibility for the UN to really have a central role in an ecosystem for future generations or for accountability to future generations.
Thank you for these very important recommendations. I feel that when I talked to Gabriela Ramos, there were some really impressive commonalities with what you said, especially on the educational materials and the building capacity of countries to being able to identify future opportunities, challenges, and supporting the communities in doing so. A lot of commonalities in what you said as well in terms of the need for thinking strategically about the current opportunities in international organizations, even if we are at a critical moment of restructuring and budget crisis, etc. But this is even more now the moment to relocate the resources that we have into resources that will have a trickle-down effect and a multiplier effect, I would prefer to say, to future generations. And I really like the idea of the Forum for Future Generations. Actually, during the negotiation of the Declaration on Future Generations, there was a first line written about a UN Forum for Future Generations that unfortunately member states rejected because they saw it as too heavy. But I'm looking at how can I revive this idea of this forum, gathering experts, policy practitioners, and civil society organizations and private sector to discuss all of the points that you talked about, the impact assessments on future generations, the concrete tools that countries can learn from each other, and also looking at connecting the communities together in order to build this sense of common purpose. So I'm really glad that we had this discussion today. Thank you for everything that you gave us as wisdom, all the stories that you told us and how it applies. It's really an honor to have a pioneer like you in the first podcast on future generations, because I wanted to go back to the genesis of the principle, how it was built, how it was thought. And we can really see in the process how inclusive and ambitious it was. And if we want to measure up to the ambition of this work, we need to go back to its roots and what best to do it on UN University. So I'll stop there unless you have a final thought that you had in your mind that didn't come up during our conversation.
Well, I have two different things that I would like to say briefly. Okay. One is on the important judicial decisions. Mm-hmm. I want to highlight that the High Court in Brazil and the courts in Brazil have had important decisions. It was a very important decision by the Supreme Court in Colombia that called for a pact for the Amazon for future generations. A very important decision in the Constitutional Court in Germany. Another very important decisions in a number of other countries. And I want to make sure that those are referenced.
Sure.
And the other thing is there may be interest in discussing a nuclear. Mm-hmm. Today, there's a lot of interest in the potential for nuclear energy that raises a lot of intergenerational issues. The question is always, if you believe and respect the principle of intergenerational equity, what do you do differently on Monday morning? And one of the things that you do differently if you're looking at nuclear energy is to see where it's being located, to be sure it's not on an earthquake site or other site, to consider when the reactor has to be decommissioned and how you're going to decommission it, and whether the funds and the resources will be available for decommissioning a reactor at that time. And finally, the question of disposal of nuclear waste and exactly where those nuclear wastes will be stored and the scientific assumptions that are made as to the safety of that and the recording of those scientific assumptions and making them available for future generations so that as science develops, we can go back and take a fresh look at that. The other example that I might raise has to do with fresh water, and it has to do with groundwater. And there is an important agreement with groundwater aquifers called the Guarani Groundwater Aquifer in Latin America, which covers a series of aquifers under the lands of Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay. It is really a very large and very huge aquifer. And what they have agreed to is a system whose purpose is supposed to be to consider both present and future generations and to conserve the aquifers for present and future generations. And it was negotiated in 2010, went into effect in 2020. But it's an important example of countries getting together to conserve and protect freshwater access for future generations. There are also examples at the global level for international agreements. I would argue that the Montreal Protocol that controls substances that deplete the ozone layer has been successful in terms of protecting the ozone layer. The World Heritage Convention has successes in terms of protecting natural and cultural resources for future generations. And I would argue that the Antarctic Treaty, which put the issue of sovereignty on ice, if you will pardon that, has also been successful so far in protecting the integrity and robustness. So we have examples at the local level, we have examples at the regional level, and we have examples at the international level of efforts to conserve our heritage and pass it on to future generations in a robust way.
Well, really, thank you for this not comprehensive, but very diverse set of examples at all levels of how this principle has been taken forward. I have recently just come across the Moon Agreement in 1979, I think, if I remember correctly, that also is about protecting the outer space for future generations, and from which was derived, I think it's the Agreement on Space Debris Prevention. So really protecting the outer space from waste and proliferation of waste as well. So I think there are lots of policy areas that we can think of to which the intergenerational equity principle can be extended. It's not only about the protection of natural resources, but as you said as well, cultural resources, and more broadly, the universe that we're living in. Very interesting set of examples.
One other example, I just want to bring to your attention a decision that took place in Kenya at a very local level. And it concerned about 100 households and industries that were dumping sewage into a river rather than using a sewage treatment plant. And it went to the court, the high court, the second highest court in Kenya. And they actually invoked a principle of intergenerational equity to stop what was doing and to say it was really also in violation of intergenerational equity, an important decision in Kenya. I wanted to cite it because it shows how the principle can be used at a very local level to do things that are important for people now, but also protect future generations from certain kinds of contamination in fresh water.
Absolutely. And it makes me think of the Goa case as well that you quoted a little bit earlier. I feel like it's kind of the same. And this is why when I was telling you a little bit earlier that I feel sometimes when it's grounded in communities, it's even more relevant for the community's passing of heritage. It's a powerful principle that can be both applied at international level, but also very locally that can speak to. And going back to what you said at the very beginning of how deep this not only principle in law, but value is anchored in our thinking, cultural heritages, it's really beautiful to see. And thank you for all the wisdom that you've passed on today. Reminding us as well what you've written in Fairness for Future Generations. If you had to not rewrite it, but to add today to it, are there any new lessons that you would add into your book, or any warnings, guardrails in addition, as you just did on misinformation and disinformation?
I think intergenerational equity can be more broadly applied than just to the earth and to cultural resources. And I would like to see that taken up on a much broader scale in the future. I think it applies to almost everything and to everybody.
Excellent. Thank you very much for this call. I think it also is a good thing to see that the Declaration on Future Generations has identified a lot of other policy areas it can be applied to, more than the preservation of natural cultural resources, but also it has been, for example, there were lots of other policy areas such as migrations, so as you said, nuclear waste and proliferation, a lot of other, let's say, entities, and also for the transformation of economic systems, of course. So yeah, thank you again. Cannot express how grateful I am.
I have one more small thing, which is there was a very important case in 1993 in the Philippines, the Miners Acosta case, where the Supreme Court recognized children as representing themselves and future generations. And it involved the timber leasing in the Philippines. But that was a very important early case, recognizing children as incorporating themselves and future generations before a Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court recognizing future generations having standing to bring suit in a national court.
Why was that? Can you explain just a little bit more this case?
The reason is that the question is, who has standing to bring a case before a court? And future generations don't physically exist yet.
Yeah.
By definition, they don't physically exist. So the argument is, you can't recognize future generations in a court proceeding. But the Philippine Supreme Court, in this Miners Acosta case, was very important and saying, yes, children can represent not only themselves, but they can represent future generations also, so that future generations do have standing, in this case, to raise the issue of a healthy and robust environment.
Oh, wow. Very interesting. It's impressive how unknown all of these cases are. And just an aparte that I'm building a database that will feature all of these cases on future generations. My goal is to have this database serve for policymakers and researchers to understand the magnitude of this movement, to which different policy areas it has been applied over the time, and how have different international agreements, such as the UNESCO Declaration and the Declaration on Future Generations, started broader policy actions, just to be able to trace it a little bit. It's going to be a combination of publicly available information, but also more in-depth conversations with the policymakers involved so that we can feature the case studies. It's going to appear as a world map, clickable, right, where you can, for example, click on Philippines and you see that there is, for example, a law specifying intergenerational equity, or a constitutional article, or a case, a litigation case, or an institution for future generations if it's a representative or something like that. I want to be able for everyone in their own country more broadly to see the magnitude and the importance of such a topic and how it has been used elsewhere. I know that there has been a climate litigation database, but not all climate litigation cases have been using the intergenerational equity principle. So this one will be a little more specific to future generations and intergenerational equity. And it's not going to be only about the litigation cases, but also about the laws, the specific policy structures, the international agreements, the resolutions that can be both used as tools for advocacy, but tools for policymaking.
Terrific. And I'm happy to help you and share the data.
That would be
very important.
That would be really amazing.
The database is now available at futuregenerations.online. If you're interested in exploring more of UNUCPR's work on future generations, you can visit unu.edu/cpr/future-generations. I am really grateful to Professor Edith Brownwise for sharing her story with us today. You can find her book, In Fairness to Future Generations, in the UN Digital Library, and it was actually published by UNU in 1992. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a review and subscribe. You can find Multilateralism Unpacked on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for more on Future Generations over the coming weeks.